your science magazine of the air. Once again, your science magazine of the air presents a stirring dramatization of one of the great discoveries of science.
It's really funny when you stop to think about it. Back in the 1850s, a young doctor wrote a thesis, see? All about a sign language for mutes, people who couldn't talk. And out of that came a part of the United States Army that's responsible for everything in communications from the field telephone to contacting the moon. It's quite an outfit we belong to, and this is part, just a part of our story. Maybe you better listen.
Of peace, the story of the United States Army in 148 years of peacetime service, presented by the American Broadcasting Company. Now part of the story of one branch of the Army, a tale of imagination, ingenuity, and sheer patience. Sign Language, starring Bert Lytell as narrator.
A 100 years ago, a young man worked and studied hard at Hobart College, Geneva, New York. His teachers knew him as a boy who could take hold of an idea and stick with it. They'd work it out, no matter what the problem might be. They liked the youngster, thought he'd go far. His teachers at Hobart were especially pleased when he moved on from there in 1847 to Buffalo Medical College. In due course, 4 years of intense study having passed, he received his degree of Doctor of Medicine, and for his graduation thesis, he wrote a special paper. On the cover of the thick, handwritten volume appeared the words,
"A Sign Language for Deaf Mutes by Alfred James Meyer, M.D.
A sign language for those who could neither hear nor speak to each other in the ordinary course of human relations. In the ordinary course of human communications. And there was the seed, sown in a medical school by a 24-year-old student. Alfred Meyer, M.D., practiced medicine in Upper New York State for 3 years. In 1854, he was commissioned an assistant surgeon, United States Army. His orders read,
"Proceed at once to report for further assignment to the commanding officer, Department of New Mexico."
You know, Lieutenant, I wouldn't half mind this station if it wasn't so darn quiet all the time.
Looking for action, eh?
It's not that, sir. It's just, well, when we're not out on patrol or chasing Indians or something, the whole country is so silent. No matter where you look, space, space, and more space.
Yes, it's quite a country for distance.
You feel so alone out here. No contact with anybody, except the next post by dispatch rider.
I've been working on an idea about that.
Dispatch riders, sir?
No. No, I've been trying to develop a system of communicating without horsemen.
Oh, like that telegraph thing that Mr. Morse invented.
No, not quite. No wires, no electricity attached to this.
Sort of sending messages through the empty air?
Sort of.
You're joking, sir.
No, I'm not.
But it's impossible.
I don't think so. Ever watch a deaf-mute talk?
That hand and finger stuff? Sure.
Well, he's communicating messages through the empty air, isn't he?
I suppose so.
Of course he is. Now then, if that deaf-mute stood on a hill, say, 5 miles from here, he could still communicate with us, couldn't he?
If we could see his hands, yeah.
But suppose instead of waving his fingers, he waved flags.
We'd see them all right, I suppose. But what about at night?
He could use lanterns or torches then, couldn't he?
Sure. Say, maybe you've got an idea there, Doc.
I think I have. Like to try it sometime?
Anytime you say.
All right. Now, look here. I've worked out a sort of code based on Mr. Morse's telegraph code and on the sign language that deaf mutes use. Someday, very soon, you're going to ride out to the ridge with some flags and the code book, and you're going to report back to me what you see on the other side of that ridge just by, well, by waving flags at me.
That was the beginning. An army doctor and a soldier at an isolated army post in New Mexico back in 1855 started an idea that grew into millions of miles of wire, into thousands of radio stations, into a business whose volume has reached more than $4 billion a year, into the ability of one man to communicate with another man on the opposite side of this earth. A doctor and a soldier with an idea and two makeshift flags in the New Mexico desert started the United States Army Signal Corps. Alfred James Meyer became the first chief signal officer of the United States Army. He invented signal flags, codes, and the use of torches at night. Among his students were Lieutenant E.P. Alexander and Lieutenant J.E.B. Jeb Stuart. They took the idea of signal communication with them into the Army of the Confederacy. But just 6 years after the first message was wigwagged from that mountain ridge in New Mexico, the war between the states began. Four long and bloody years swept by. Signal Corps grew in leaps and bounds. Military telegraph came into being in the Civil War. Special army trains containing poles, generators, batteries, instruments, reels of wire were designed and put into action by the new-fledged Signal Corps. Signalmen worked with naval landing parties to direct the fire of the big guns. Admiral Farragut used army signalmen, and to excellent purpose.
Lieutenant, Admiral Farragut's compliments, sir. Will you proceed topside at once?
We've been ordered to stay below until contact is about to be made with the Union Army.
Yes, but it's necessary to communicate with our other ships. The Admiral wishes you to take over this duty at once, sir.
Oh, with pleasure. Seems the army on the water will contribute something to the Battle of Mobile Bay after all.
The war and time never stand still. Wars come to an end. Time goes on. And the mind of man moves with it. 5 years after the meeting at Appomattox ended the war between the states,
the Congress of the United States authorizes the Secretary of War to provide for taking meteorological observations at military stations, for giving notice on the northern lakes and on the sea coast by magnetic telegraph and marine signaling of the approach and force of storms.
That was February 9, 1870. The wire stretched across Midwestern United States. 25 observation posts with specially recruited and specially trained sergeant observers began sending information to the Signal Corps headquarters in Washington. In October 1871, the first storm signal was flown at Oswego, New York. And that same year, the service was extended to Canada and then to the West Indies. And in 1873...
What's coming off the line, Larry?
Storm warning, Army Signal Corps. Hurricanes sweeping northward from Caribbean area. Warn all Coast Guard life-saving stations and all lighthouses on Atlantic coast to Hatteras.
Trouble?
Well, it doesn't affect us here at Barnegat yet. But there'll be a lot of ship captains to the south who'll appreciate this.
Hold your course, quartermaster.
Aye, aye, sir. Hold course.
Having difficulty?
Yes, sir. Wind seems to be lifting the stern out of the water. Rudder is hardly answering.
She won't take much more of this pounding. Pretty bad, mister?
Pretty bad.
I'll take over. Go below and get yourself some coffee. What's the course?
Course 283.
That's for Norfolk. Thought we were bound for New York.
We were. But the lookout picked up a storm signal ashore, warning all ships to port. Hurricane. We changed course for Norfolk.
Good enough. I hope we make it.
If we do, it'll be thanks to the new system. I understand those storm warnings are based on telegraph reports handled by the Army Signal Corps.
Yeah. I'll drink that coffee with a safer feeling, mister. It's worth a chuckle, you know, when a sailor's life is made safer by the Army.
The wire stretched from the far north to every coastal station on the Atlantic seaboard. Warnings were flashed. Lives were saved. Sailing the seven seas became just that much safer. And in the meantime, far to the west, back in the territory where Alfred Meyer had first made a signal with a swinging flag, the Signal Corps was busy with its routine job, serving the nation. 5,000 miles of telegraph lines were strung, operated, and maintained, linking our mid-continent outposts with the Pacific coast, establishing and maintaining the lines of communication by signal that helped so much to make and keep our nation one. In 1898, we fought a war to liberate a people. The Signal Corps was there, of course, connecting Cuba and the fighting fronts with Key West, Florida, by cable. And as the new century turned the pages of the calendars marked 1900, our eyes turned northward once again to that far-flung, huge, and fabulous country called Alaska.
An act of Congress, May 26, 1900. There will be extensive military telegraph and cable lines in Alaska.
The Signal Corps was put to work.
Insulator set.
All set, Dad.
And here comes the wire.
Got it.
Set it right now.
All secure. Take more than a blizzard to knock this down.
Boy, oh boy. This job I'm satisfied to work is fast.
Well, that's nice of you, soldier. Any special reason?
You move fast. You keep warm, see? You know what the temperature is right now?
Go on. Surprise me.
72 degrees below zero. Wonder what it's like up here in summer.
Got him that time.
Yeah, so you got him. You also dropped the wire in the water.
Sorry, Sarge. No harm done. But I could do without the mosquitoes.
Yeah, so could I. The sooner we get the line into Dawson, the sooner you'll be away from here. And the mosquitoes.
...1,740 miles of telegraph wire along the Yukon, through the swamps, over the glacial rivers, down the canyons, into the tangled underbrush, and through the great forest. 1,700 miles of slender wire connecting these United States to the far outpost of the Northland, strung by the men of the Signal Corps. So well, so smoothly, so permanently that the report of the chief signal officer in 1902 contained these words.
Certain it is that no body of men in Alaska render more faithful and valuable service to the country than do the enlisted men of the Army, especially on the telegraph trail.
And so half the job was done. That act of Congress, 1900, used another word as well as telegraph. The word was
cable.
And that's how it happened, and not for the first time in its history, that the Army put out to sea. The cable came from Bayonne, New Jersey, destined to link Sitka with Seattle. Now, of course, there was no Panama Canal in 1903. So the cable traveled all the way around the Horn, from Bayonne, New Jersey, clear around two continents. The Army took it over in Alaska, placed it aboard the cable ship USS Burnside in the fall of 1903. The fall, when winds and seas are high, when winter has already clamped its icy fist upon the country and the men up there in the far, far north.
Hey, look at Larry.
All right, what's so funny about me?
The fancy beard you grew. Between the winter and the spray, you look like a cross between Santa Claus and an icicle.
Very funny. Come on, let's get to him.
I've been going for 600 miles. Where we go now?
This is the end of the line for the winter.
I see. Lay 600 miles of cable and then just drop it because the weather's cold.
Drop it? Nothing. Scuttlebutt says we're coming back to get it in the spring.
Just like this? I suppose the end of a 600-mile rubber-covered cable will float out here all winter. Or will the seals hold it up for us?
Claude is right. We're hooking the end of it to a buoy. And when the winter's over, we're coming back, picking it up, and going on with the job.
This is our position, sir. 47 degrees, 52 minutes north, by 128 degrees, 12 minutes west.
Very well, mister. Bring the engine room. Quarter speed forward.
Aye, sir.
The buoy ought to be in sight in this area, mister.
Yes, sir. Strange that there's been no lookout reporting it as yet.
And no lookout ever did report it. Because the winter storms had washed the buoy away, left no marker on the sea, left no trace of the end of 600 miles of submarine cable somewhere under the Pacific Ocean.
We'll just have to go back and start over again. But I think we can recover that cable. Even if we have to pick it up at Sitka and trace it to its end.
So the Burnside sailed back to Sitka and recovered the lost cable. The Signal Corps ship set out again, and this time the task was done. The mission completed. The submarine cable from Seattle, Washington to Sitka, Alaska, became another link in the network of American communications in August 1904. Built, maintained, and operated by the United States Army Signal Corps. Great as these accomplishments are, prelude to further greatness that they've been, there is another field in which the Signal Corps pioneered, another means of communication that this branch of the Army did much to develop. The beginning, well, we might say it began in the early days of the war between the states.
Observer reporting, sir.
Very well.
Movement of cavalry on South Bank, James River. Scouting party operating west of it. Picket line. 5th Infantry.
Have there been any confirmations of this report?
No, sir. Sergeant Observer McCollum has a rather vantage point.
Yes, he has at that. Very well. Encode and transmit the following message. Headquarters, Armies of the Potomac. Observation reports indicate enemy movement, South Bank, James River. There has been no report on this movement except this one. Received from a Sergeant Observer aboard a captive balloon.
There it is, balloon. As far back as the Civil War, the Signal Corps made use of lighter-than-air aircraft to lengthen and broaden the vision of the eyes of the Army. Aeronautics, they called it then. Aviation is the word today. But the first to use military aircraft of any kind was the Signal Corps.
December 1907. The Signal Corps will entertain bids for a heavier-than-air flying machine, speed 40 miles per hour. Remain in the air 1 hour and to be at all times under control. Specifications are as follows.
$50,000 planes a year. $100,000. P-80s, B-29s, Skymasters, Commandos. $400,000, $500,000, $700 mile an hour flight. Unknown. Undreamed of. Well, perhaps not quite undreamed of. There was great vision in the hearts and souls of the men who flew those box kites back in 1907.
This is quite good, Mr. Wright. But a little cold up here.
Where we go, the colder it'll be. Our speed is making it still colder. How do you feel about the plane, Lieutenant Selfridge?
It flies very smoothly. I shall be interested to see how well it lands.
It's easy enough to land it.
Mr. Wright, can you control the plane?
I can try it.
Try to jump clear, Lieutenant! Try to jump clear!
Selfridge Field. A great Army air base is named for the young lieutenant who gave his life in that early crash. The Wright brother with him is badly hurt, too. But, as always, the work went on, keeping this nation in pace with the progress of other nations.
June 1911. First Army Aviation School opened at College Park, Georgia.
1912. Congress appropriates $125,000 for Army airplanes.
March 1913. Two Army pilots establish cross-country record. 240 miles in return, Texas City to San Antonio. 1916. The aviation section of the Signal Corps places airplanes at the disposal of General John J. Pershing in Mexico.
The rest is history. History that we've lived through and that we remember. The First World War made aviation a fact. The Second made aviation a daily part of our daily lives. Conceived by the air-minded men of the Signal Corps. First used by them to widen the vision of the Army. Because out of their efforts and their pioneering grew the United States Army Air Force. Gather the information and send the communication. Those are the primary purposes of the Signal Corps in war and in peace. Matters not one bit where the information may be. Some way will be found to gather it and send it on. The weather's a case in point. Weather begins far out of sight, beyond the atmosphere. But why send men up there when a machine will do? The radio sonde is called a tiny free balloon filled with helium, carrying with it in its flight a small but very powerful radio transmitter connected to the instruments that tell of humidity, atmospheric pressure, and temperature. Up it goes, rising high above the earth, out of sight and hearing. 10 miles or more above the earth, into the stratosphere. No man, no human hand to guide it, just the free winds and the dark blue sky around it. And all the while, the radio is sending information on the weather. Information charted and recorded on a moving strip of paper in the receiving set back here on Earth. Information will protect airplanes and ships, tell the farmers when the rains will come, or the city dweller when to leave his umbrella home. Eventually, of course, the balloon will burst. The machine will fall. But in its bursting, the balloon itself releases a tiny parachute that slows the fall, brings the precious radio and weather instruments safely back to Earth, to be used perhaps a dozen times again on these journeys after information to be communicated to us groundlings here. Such is the simple yet tremendous story of the magic in the radio sound. Eyes for the weatherman, 10 miles straight up into the stratosphere. And they go farther still, these men, with cross flags upon their collar badges. Into the hospitals they come, and gently tap a patient on the shoulder.
How'd you like to try something new, fellow?
Something new?
Yes. We're working on a gadget that'll help you to get around, but without a cane.
Oh, you're kidding. What is it, radar?
Well, it works on that principle. Only it uses light instead of shortwave radio.
Yeah, I'd like to try that. It's not being blind, I mind, half as much as feeling I've got to depend on strangers to help me get around.
Okay, then, let's try this gadget. What do you say?
What's it like?
Well, it looks like a lunchbox. Only it has batteries and small motors and a light inside. Now, the light is focused by a lens in a path 20 feet ahead of you. When the light hits anything, it bounces back, hits a photoelectric cell, and you hear a signal in the little earphone you wear. Here. Try it.
Feels all right. Hey. I hear dots and dashes.
That's right. That's the signal for 20 feet. You see, the light from the box is hitting a chair way over there. Now, listen to the signal change as you get closer to the chair.
Say, this is swell. I'll bet I could walk right over and sit on that. Hey, what was that?
One of your neighbors walked between you and the light, so you heard him, see?
See, you're not kidding. Here you are. Why, it is practically seeing with my ears at any rate. Who have I got to thank for this?
Well, when we've got it really perfected and the medical department is satisfied that it will really do the job, you can thank the Signal Corps.
Thank the Signal Corps for a new eye that may soon be on its way into the hands of blind men and women everywhere. For the wires strung up and down this nation, binding coast to coast, boundary to boundary, territories to the continent. For the beginnings of the greatest air force in the world. For the ingenuity, the inventiveness in peace as well as war. That spells safety, progress, a wider, freer, better life for everyone in the years to come. Yes. Thank the Signal Corps so many times for adhering to the watchwords.
The difficult we do at once. The impossible takes a little longer.
This is Bert Lytell. We have told you some of the achievements of the United States Army Signal Corps. The almost incredible, yet perfectly true story of the growth of Army communications. And now, tomorrow lies ahead. What tomorrow has in store, no man may tell, but man may plan. One man who has the picture of tomorrow clear in his mind is Major General Willard S. Paul of the War Department General Staff. He can tell us of tomorrow, today. So, go ahead, General Paul in Washington.
Scientific research and development in new military fields will continue to be an important peacetime work of Army men. Startling strides have been made since the end of hostilities. Flying an Army P-80, Colonel William Council crossed the United States in 4 hours, 13 minutes, and 26 seconds. Signal Corps technicians contacted the moon by radar, proving radio impulses can penetrate the ionosphere. Ordnance technicians are testing captured German V-bombs. Weighing 15 tons, speeding 3,400 miles per hour, and reaching as high as 100 miles above the Earth, these rockets are now equipped with specially modified electronic devices designed by Signal Corps technicians to tell us more about the secrets of the upper atmosphere.
Have been listening to your science magazine of the air. Today's story entitled Sign Language was one of the series Warriors of Peace.